Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new Rise of the Planet of the Apes was number one at the box office last weekend. The Planet of the Apes prequel, or reboot as it's being called, picks up before the 1968 Charlton Heston original. Then we saw a post-apocalyptic planet with apes in charge, humans in cages. The new film shows how these apes got so smart. Think science run amok. So what keeps us coming back to the apes on top theme? This hour on Point, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and what it says about us. You can join the conversation, what keeps us coming back to the theme of ape takeover? What are we afraid of, fascinated by? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Theme music from the new music behind us. Let's go back for just a moment to the 1968 original, Planet of the Apes. Charlton Heston plays astronaut George Taylor, who crash lands on a planet dominated by apes. Kim Hunter plays the chimpanzee, Zira, a scientist, chimpanzee scientist, specializing in humans. In this scene, Taylor has managed to escape Zira's custody, but not for long.
Go get him!
Taylor! Why did you run away?
Security police.
I'm in charge of this man.
No longer, madam. He is now in the custody of the Ministry of Science.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Charlton Heston talking tough, but he's not in charge in Planet of the Apes. Now they're back, the 2011 Rise of the Planet of the Apes. In that film, the new film out just this last a few days, San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge is overrun by angry apes. They are back. We will hear in this hour from one of the writer-producers of the new film, Rick Jaffa, and from a woman who is one of the world's top great ape scientists. But joining me first, now from Indianapolis, is Paul Mullins, chair of the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He teaches an anthropology class in which he uses Planet of the Apes as course material. Professor Mullins, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Also with us from Raleigh, North Carolina, is film writer Lewis Beale. He covered Rise of the Planet of the Apes for Newsday. Lewis Beale, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Hi. So there's been, what, seven of these in total? Pretty inconsistent quality, so you don't know what to expect. But this one's getting pretty darn good reviews. Ty Burr, the Boston Globe, calls it part Frankenstein, part Spartacus. Kenneth Turan, L.A. Times, says it has some of the most potent species versus species conflict since Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Tell us about the story a little bit of the new one, Lewis Beale. What's the tale this time?
Well, this is basically one of those be careful what you wish for kind of stories. James Franco plays a research scientist who's researching a cure for Alzheimer's, and he's testing it on chimps. And what he finds is that the chimps' intelligence increases, but they also become more aggressive. So the experiment is basically shut down, but he takes one of the chimps home with him and keeps experimenting with the chimp, and that chimp, it turns out, becomes the main protagonist of the film, whose name's Caesar, who becomes intelligent and sort of leads a kind of this Spartacus-like revolt against the humans.
So it turns out that the great ape intelligence that we saw in the earlier films, this film would have it, is the result of human science run amok, Lewis.
Yes, that's exactly what it portrays. And at one point, the film also shows that he does cure Alzheimer's for humans also, but the serum is kind of problematic. But it's pretty much about how the apes increase their intelligence with this serum.
Paul Mullins in Indianapolis, how do you see the evolution of these films over time? They've always made a big impression. First one, and the impulse for all of them, out of a French novel from Pierre Boulle way back in the earlier 60s. But what do you see at work here, Paul Mullins, in human fascination with this dynamic, this fictional portrayal of apes on top?
I think all of the movies, really the first five and certainly this last one, are all a kind of dystopian films. They're all about apprehension. Those first five are really about racial apocalypse, and they're very firmly rooted in a historical moment with the civil rights movement, a little bit about nuclear apocalypse as well. And I think this movie, you hit the nail right on the head. This one, really, the apprehension has shifted a little bit from that notion of a racial dystopianism to this kind of fear of our very capacity to shape our own genetics. And that's all projected onto our very closest relatives. So it has it aesthetically is very powerful. We also kind of we've come to understand that apes are our very closest relatives in every genetic sense. They look like us. So it's a very powerful emotional and aesthetic mechanism to move this story.
So why – I mean, you begin to touch on it there. But why do you think we're projecting these dystopias onto our closest relative? Why choose apes for this, you know, not fighting frogs or something else?
I think actually the story just works better actually if it's projected onto this very closest relative, because I think we very much understand. You go to the zoo, you see chimpanzees, you can see instantly they're social animals. They have groups, their hierarchies, their gender rules, their social rules within the group. They use tools. I mean, we understand all of that at a very – you know, most of us understand all that stuff. So I think it's much more powerful than if it was the planet of our, you know, our domestic pets, our, you know, the planet of the cats.
Louis Beale, how about it? Does it just figure in the new version, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, that, you know, a little pill and that close relative is a real challenger?
Well, I think it's really important at this point to bring up something. There was recently released a documentary called Project NIMH.
Yes.
And it's about a real life experiment with a chimpanzee back in the 70s where someone tried to teach them sign language. And in a sense, Rise of the Planet of the Apes is almost like the Hollywood version of Project NIMH. You know, the scientists who were working on Project NIMH assumed that because the apes are our nearest relatives, that maybe we could learn to communicate with them. And I think that's what plays, obviously, into the apes movies also, is that, as the professor said, we see them in the zoo, we see a similarity here, we see some intelligence in their eyes, and they're the obvious choice for, you know, gaining more intelligence and then trying to overthrow us. But also, again, I think we go back to we experiment on these animals all the time, and that's also part of the ethos of these movies, about how we mistreat them.
Louis Beale, Paul Mullen, stand by. I want to bring our callers right in. Mary Jean in Burlington, Vermont. Mary Jean, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree completely with your last speaker. I think that the reason that it makes some of us nervous is that we often do not treat animals very well, either as experiments or generally speaking. A lot of society considers animals to be throwaway objects, if
mm-hmm.
you were.
Yep.
And this movie kind of brings out that real possibility that maybe the tide will turn, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. So in a way, this is humans, what, toying with their own guilt or an awareness of how we've put our supremacy so far above animals, treated them?
Yes, and the way we experiment on them for our own use, often for things like cosmetics or not even for life-saving reasons.
Just for a little better blush. Mary Jean, I appreciate your call. Paul Mullins, of course, it is interesting that this film has come out in the same time period as Project NIMH, the Project NIMH film that Lewis refers to, where a young chimpanzee is taught sign language, adopted by a human mother, breastfed by that mother, raised nearly as a human child, and then just coldly thrown back in a cage and once again treated as an experimental animal. I mean, the cruelty of it is stark, as cruel as really anything depicted on the apes' part in these films, Paul.
Yeah, well, the movies are very much a allegory about what shall happen if the meek inherit the earth. It's very much about our apprehension of that very power that we have to shape everything from genetics to color line politics to nuclear warfare. So they really all play on some very, very deep-seated apprehensions.
As an anthropologist, you know, do you see this as a, I don't know, some kind of Hollywood continuation of tension that was there, I don't know what the right date is, 40 million years ago when apes and, you know, Homo sapien contested turf?
Well, we didn't really contest turf with apes per se, you know, in evolutionary terms. But I think actually it's probably a little problematic to look at it as completely and utterly timeless. But there's very much certainly I think in many of us there's a very deep-seated apprehension that we have so much power and that we understand that we are of nature, yet we are separated from nature in very kind of critical ways. And we both we embrace that power, and at the same time we fear it a little bit.
these films have been used again and again to look at hot issues of the day, as you say, from race in times closer to the civil rights era to the nuclear threat, and now in the latest to this era of genetic engineering and science. In this case, the humans, Paul Mullins, kind of outsmarting themselves.
Yeah, I think it's I think there's a little bit of a kind of fear of technology, you know, at the basis of this particular movie, and that separates it a little bit from the first five. It really, the first five is really a bit more about the fear of kind of social relationships along and across the color line. And I think this movie actually speaks much more closely to that power we now have to shape genetics.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Planet of the Apes and the popular imagination and the latest box office topper, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. We've been joined by Paul Mullins, chair of the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and by Louis Beale, a film writer. He wrote up Rise of the Planet of the Apes for Newsday. Let's hear a little more. Go all the way back to the original, 1968, off the 1963 French novel adopted therefrom. And in the original, again, the chimpanzee, they've got orangutans, kind of the leader's chimpanzee, the smart guys, apes, the gorillas, the enforcers. But here's the chimpanzee, Zira, played by Kim Hunter. She's a psychiatrist who specializes in studying humans. She's intrigued with the newly captured and seemingly precocious human, played by Charlton Heston. But Zira's superior, Zaius, is the Minister of Science, played by Maurice Evans. He does not share her scientific curiosity about this lowly human.
Wonder how he'd score on a Hopkins manual dexterity test.
An animal?
Look, he's moving his fingers.
Only because he saw you moving yours.
No, but perhaps he understood.
Man has no understanding. He can be taught a few simple tricks, nothing more.
Apes on top, humans on the bottom in the original Planet of the Apes. In the new film, James Franco plays scientist Will Rodman, who brings Caesar home to live with him. And his father, played by John Lithgow. One day, Caesar witnesses a heated encounter between their belligerent neighbor and Lithgow's character. After Caesar attacks the neighbor, he's relocated to a primate facility. In this scene, Franco's character visits him.
I'm taking him out of here. Right now.
Not without a court order, you're not.
Hey. No, we're not going home right now. But I'm going to get you out of here. I promise. You have to trust me. Caesar, you have to trust me, okay?
I think this visit's over.
It'll be okay.
It'll be okay, he says, but it's not so simple. Paul Mullins, Louis Beale, stand by. Joining us right now from Los Angeles, Rick Jaffa, one of the writers and producers of Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Rick Jaffa, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the film's reception by both critics and audience at this point. You're doing well, and that has not always been the case with this family of films. What brought you back to Planet of the Apes as a target, Rick?
Well, the truth is, I was a big fan of the original series, especially the 68 film. Mm-hmm. Had a huge impact on my childhood and my love for movies. But the truth is, the idea came from a different direction. We weren't looking to jump back into the franchise per se. I had cut out a number of articles over the years about families who were raising chimpanzees in their homes, like almost as if they were children, in some case, treating them as if they were literally their child.
Right.
And then at some point, the chimpanzees, grow out of being small, cute, and cuddly, and the hormones kick in. They become teenagers and become, what they're meant to be, which is powerful and sometimes violent animals. And so the truth is, I stared at those articles for maybe 2 years, thinking there had to be a great story there, a great movie there, quite frankly, in a very quiet moment, a little voice in my head said, it's Planet of the Apes. And I went into Amanda's office, my wife and writing partner.
Yes.
And said, you know, I've got this idea. I think it's kind of nutty, but it's very exciting. And she said, what is it? And I said, well, I think we're going to reinvent Planet of the Apes. And she looked at me like I was out of my mind. But the truth is we started talking about the character of Caesar and a chimpanzee raised in a home. And it really became a character study more than anything else.
Caesar starts out as a vulnerable, very, very young chimp, ape, and ends up in your film as a very smart and powerful military leader challenging humans.
Right.
Ty Burr of the Boston Globe says it's part Frankenstein, part Spartacus. Do you
well,
see it as the
good company? Yeah,
it's pretty good. Do you see it as the rise of the dispossessed here, or just humans screwing up their pills?
Well, you know, both in a way. Amanda and I landed on a theme very early on, which we believe was arguably the theme of the '68 film, which is that a man's hubris can be his downfall. And, man is not meant to play God. And so we held on to that through the writing of every draft over, you know, over the course of like 5 years. So there's certainly that aspect to it. But it's also, you know, a Moses story, really. And, you take an unlikely character, or Spartacus, and you take an unlikely character and set the wheels in motion so that they can rise to be a great leader.
Louis Beale, what do you think of it as film work?
I think the film was surprisingly good, and I have to admit that there's an incredible coolness factor to the whole picture, especially the ending battle on the Golden Gate Bridge, which is just an absolutely spectacular action set piece. But I also think that the CGI work is really terrific, and the motion capture work, which turned Andy Serkis, the actor, into an ape, is as good as anything that's ever been done. But it also really makes the chimp into a real character, a real human. You see things through his eyes that you'd never expect to see in the eyes of an animal. And also, I have to say, without giving away any spoilers, that the ending shot, I think, is one of the great shots in film history, and it really sets up fabulously for a sequel that I'm sure everyone who's seen the movie can't wait for.
Professor Mullins, how about as the anthropologist? What did you make of the film? And what's your question for the co-writer, Rick Jaffa, with us here from L.A.?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not speaking as a film critic, but just as an anthropologist and as a film fan, you know, I think the reason the movie works is because it's not simply a summer movie about pure escapism. I mean, that might work for a single weekend, but that's not what really timeless movies are made of. You know, there has to be something that makes us come back to a film over and over again. And I think actually the thing that's interesting, even though the graphics are incredible, the aesthetics of the movie, it really is a beautiful movie to look at. But so was Burton's, and it has not held up very well. But in this movie, you really do root for the apes. You root for the underdog. There's some kind of emotional attachment to the apes. And I think that's really critical to move the story. Because then, you know, it ends up essentially we look at ourselves in the mirror when we begin to root for the underdog in this case.
And why do you root for the apes? Just because humans have treated them badly, Professor Mullins?
Because they're treated terribly. When Caesar is placed, you know, when Caesar is captured and he's placed in this jail, he's treated very poorly. And we have that moment of kind of there's a kind of self-loathing. You know, this is how we treat our very closest relatives, a really noble, incredible animal. And I think there's just this moment of apprehension of ourselves. So we begin to root for Caesar. We want him to get back at these guys.
It was never just summer fun, I guess. At the very end of the 1968 original Planet of the Apes, Charlton Heston's character, the astronaut George Taylor, rides down a beach on horseback, waves crashing ashore. For the entire film, he's believed he was on an alien planet. But in this final scene, he comes upon the Statue of Liberty half buried in sand and realizes that humans, this is, remember, in the age of great nuclear fear, that humans had blown it.
Oh, my God. I'm back. I'm home. All the time. We finally, really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, I'm
damn you! God damn you all to hell!
Speaking of Moses, there's Charlton Heston doing his thing. But it gets serious in these films. Rick Jaffa is with us, writer and producer of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, box office topper just this last weekend. Rick, we've got callers for you. Jerry in Exeter, Rhode Island. You're on with the writer and producer of the latest. Jerry, what did you think?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I saw it Sunday, and I thought it was absolutely terrific. It was an excellent job. And I've seen all of them. I saw the first one back in '68 with Charlton
wow.
Heston.
Okay.
And I've watched them all several times, and I really, really enjoyed this because I think it of all the movies, this one gave credibility to how Caesar was actually created, and I thought that was excellent because in some of the other ones, it was from domestication of the apes, and they started to learn, and then they overtook, and then of course. In this one, it's a lot more plausible than like all the callers have said. It talks about it kind of alludes to the fact that we're not the masters of our own destinies, and if we're not careful with some of the things that we fool around with, it can get us in a lot of trouble. The other point I want to make is my daughter and son-in-law are both primatologists.
Okay,
and they've studied monkeys and apes all over the world. They spent 2 years in the jungles of Guyana. They go back to Vietnam. They've been to Africa. And after talking to them and their experiences with primates, I mean, it's just absolutely incredible what these animals are. And they are extremely intelligent, they're extremely social, and I think in most cases, they're pretty much misunderstood by a lot of people. So I just thought hats off to the movie.
Hey, Jerry, thanks very much for that. We're going to hear from a real ape specialist before this hour is over. Rick Jaffa, we've just got you for a few more minutes. I wish you'd tell us about one piece of this. You know, of course, if we go all the way back, it was pretty crude by contemporary standards, makeup that made the apes back in '68. Now you're using CGI. Some people love it, some don't. But tell us about how it works. I mean, and the role of Andy Serkis here, the actor who was behind or somewhere buried in the CGI around Gollum in Lord of the Rings, around in King Kong. He's becoming kind of an expert at playing this digitally enhanced character. How does it work? How do you make the grown ape here?
Well, I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that question in terms of how it, you know, specifically works in a technological way. But I will say that Andy is a brilliant actor, and we were very lucky to get him. He came on about a week before we started shooting the script, and so it was a great boon for us to have him. But the truth is that He was around the set in a gray leotard the whole time. He and a handful of the other actors, Terry Notary, who plays Rocket, and taught everyone how to move like an ape and so forth.
Yeah.
And they used this. Oweta used the same technology as they had in Avatar. And the big difference here, the great leap here, was that for the first time ever, they were doing it on practical locations. It wasn't in a controlled. Atmosphere like on a soundstage, but actually a lot of it was shot outside.
So it catches the essential body motion of the actor and then elaborates digitally on that to give us the final result on film.
I'm sorry, you're saying that is what happens?
Yes. Am I correct? Is that what?
Yes, you are. As mm-hmm. a matter of fact, it's wild. Amanda and I did the commentary for the DVD yesterday, and mm-hmm. we've seen the cut so many times, but you have to realize that the first several dozen cuts that we saw was Andy, without the CGI effects. And
right.
so you get to know his performance really well. And now, as we sit and see it completed, I'm telling you guys, it is Andy up there on the screen. And they captured the emotion that he brought to every scene and the power that he brought to every scene, the turns in the character. And it's really a performance capture ability now. And I think, that this particular film has just given that great stride.
The human still within or behind the ape there. We're still at this point in charge. Bill in Middletown, Connecticut. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi. I asked myself after seeing the movie, which was surprisingly good, why is it that it seems we are reverting to dealing with issues of human concern more and more through animals, aliens, ghosts, monsters, they're all over the place. And so I thought about it long and hard. There's lots of reasons. And these are all good movies. I'm not criticizing them.
Yep.
But I got the answer that I think we're very lonely. And
lonely as a species. We want another species to talk to.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll listen to you off the air. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Rick Jaffa, how about it? We're lonely. We want to talk to the apes.
Well, it's interesting because in some of the drafts earlier on, you know, James Franco character, Will, was a very lonely guy. And then eventually the role of Charles, his father, John Lithgow, came to be. So I don't know. You know, we really tried to create a character that people could relate to, and especially anyone that is or has ever been a teenager. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Caesar does go through a crisis of identity, and he wonders, well, where does he fit in? Who is he? What is his role? And when he attacks the neighbor, you know, he's just really doing what part of him is meant to do, which is to protect his clan, you know, protect his family, mm-hmm. and in an aggressive way, and yet he gets punished horribly for it. And so, you know, I think that goes along with a lot of the other things the other gentlemen are saying, that yes, all those things are very valid, but at its core, we really wanted people just to identify with Caesar's journey.
Rick, have you left room for another prequel before you catch up with Charlton Heston in 1968 here? I presume you have.
Well, absolutely we have. You know, I there's a lot of story to tell. I mean, we haven't had time really to talk specifics with Fox yet, but yes, absolutely. We felt, Amanda and I felt all along, that if this were to work and we were able to do a sequel, that people would really want to know what happens afterwards, and how does the planet become inhabited, and you know, what happens to these characters, more specifically the Maurice, Buck, Rocket, you know, and especially Caesar, what happens after that.
And that climactic battle on the Golden Gate Bridge, I guess that wasn't really on the bridge. That was somewhere made up in Vancouver.
Exactly. It was crazy. We recreated a big chunk of the bridge, I'd say about the size of a football field and a parking lot. In Vancouver, and so a lot of that, it was very exciting, but you know, a lot of it also is hats off to Weta, you know, the kind of the wizards of visual effects, because it really comes out strong. But you know, we were really encouraged and pushed by Fox to come up with some kind of iconic image, mm-hmm. you know, for the end of the movie, or at least for a big chunk of the end of the movie to take place. And we never, ever wanted to try to compete with the Statue of Liberty scene in any way. Eventually, there was always a rush for freedom led by Caesar and all the drafts, but eventually we landed on the idea of the Golden Gate Bridge, and it works really well.
Well, strong reception so far, and we congratulate you on it. Rick Jaffa, writer and producer of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, joining us from Los Angeles. Rick, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Planet of the Apes series. It goes all the way back to the French 1963 novel by Pierre Boulle. 1968, Charlton Heston there is the astronaut on that planet, apes in charge, humans in cages, humans thought to be, you know, the subpar species there. There have been many since, and the latest, just out this last weekend, topped the box office, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Paul Mullins has joined us this hour, chair of the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Lewis Beale, features writer who writes primarily about the film industry, is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina, wrote about this latest film for Newsday recently. And joining us right now from Des Moines, Iowa, is Sue Savage Rumbaugh, primatologist at the Great Ape Trust. It's an organization dedicated to understanding ape language and cognition. Previously spent 30 years at Georgia State University's Language Research Center. She's the first and only scientist to conduct in-depth language research with bonobos. She was earlier this year, named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for giving me a chance to talk about this wonderful movie.
I think you saw it just last night. You know all about apes. What was your reaction?
I was impressed and I was shocked. I think the movie is going to radically change the current mythology of how we view the human-ape divide.
What do you mean by that?
Well, humans always need some metric by which to define themselves, and it's typically the other, the people that aren't us. In 1912, a chimpanzee and a human pygmy were put on display in the World's Fair, and the human pygmy was thought to be the intermediary species between ourselves and the ape. And that was how we defined ourselves at the time. Since then, anthropology has taught us that humans are really of equal intellectual capacity no matter where you find them on the planet, and the difference is cultural. So that made the other immediately become the ape, and this movie's going to change that.
What about the earlier movies? I mean, they made the apes look pretty fearsome. Does this one...
The apes were fearsome, and the apes were also not real. Because of the computer graphics, these apes are real, and as many people have already said on your show, hey, they are rooting for the apes. I think in the others, we were all rooting for the people. Now we're rooting for the apes. That's a huge turnaround, and that's been accomplished by this movie, and it's been accomplished because the apes are the good guys in this movie. They aren't experimenting with things they don't really understand. They're self-aware. They're intelligent. Whenever they are aggressive, many, many, many times, they refuse to bite somebody. They hit them. It's only in the rare occasions when they're pushed beyond all extreme that they're actually aggressive. Humans are the bad, aggressive species in this movie. And without thinking it, the movie's turned the tables.
Boy, humans coming out on the short end of the stick in another way this time. Sue, please stand by there. I want to get Caitlin on the line from New York City calling in. Caitlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. Hi. And Dr. Savage-Rumbaugh.
Hi, hi. Yes. What do you know, Caitlin?
I've just graduated with a degree in animal behavior, and I'm going on to work in anthrozoology. And related to that point, I feel like this movie and the other Planet of the Apes movies, for me at least, kind of give a sense of hope, because humans, we've been so violent and we've done so many things that are so detrimental to our own planet that it kind of gives a sense of when we completely destroy ourselves, either through science or war, that there will be something else that takes over. The planet will keep going, and that something else will take over as the sort of stewards of our world when we're not able to do that anymore.
I guess, even if it's just algae, but it may be something closer to us. It's an interesting observation, and I appreciate it. Sue, I'll bring that to you, but Paul Mullins, first to you. Did you see in this film a kind of contemporary urge to shrug off the mantle of supreme species that we've given ourselves?
Yeah, I don't know if it's we're trying to shrug off the mantle, but we're certainly uncomfortable with the mantle. There are always human characters in each of these movies that we're sympathetic to. But, you know, in general, many of the humans in both of these movies, we have a somewhat problematic sense for it. And I think it really is powerful in this movie that, you know, we're not sympathetic to many of the people. We're really sympathetic to all of these chimpanzees and really fearful of our very power.
Louis Beale, I think you've seen them all. How does that place this movie in the context of the others in terms of where sympathies go?
Well, I think that we're forgetting that in the first movie, Cornelius and Zira, who are the scientists who actually discover that Taylor can speak and is a human being, are sympathetic characters. And I think one of the things about the movie is that the first film paints kind of a dogmatic picture of the ape society, where you have a dogmatic religion, a militaristic structure, and a kind of a dogmatic scientific thinking. But Cornelius and Zira are the ones who are really using the scientific method to try and discover the truth. So I think there's kind of a divided loyalties in these films, and also in the third movie, when Cornelius and Zira go back into the past and wind up in contemporary Los Angeles, they are treated as celebrities, and they are very sympathetic characters. So I think that I'm not sure that the film really reflects our anxiety about our place in the world and about who we sympathize with. Because I think the films basically sympathize with good people or good simians on both sides of the divide.
Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, where do you see this latest film locating hope and where locating fear?
Well, I certainly realize that yes, it's a great fear that we might misuse our ability to manipulate genetics and change the order on the planet. The fact that the movie presents the ape expressions so beautifully, and you can actually see the intelligence on the ape's face through their eyes and how they express their emotions, is not just presenting a good ape character with whom you can sympathize. It is allowing, for the first time, humanity to almost jump into the body of an ape and look through the eyes of that ape. And that's why some of the scenes on the bridge and everything are so enjoyable, because by that time, you really want to be there with those apes bounding over those cars. You really wish you could do that. You would like that kind of physicality to your body, which in our human society, where are we? We're trapped in those traffic jams, and they're hot and
yeah,
messy, you know?
Right.
So there's a real allure to that kind of thing.
Ryan is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Ryan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To me, the films, the Planet of the Apes films, have always seemed to be much less about the way we treat animals or a fear of technology or misuse, as much as kind of a way of having a dialogue of the way throughout history we've subjugated other groups and kind of devaluized them, either based on class or race or faith and what have you. And you know, we devaluize a group of people so much, and then they get the upper hand, what could happen that we could have prevented simply by treating each other like the human beings that we are. And I think if we look around the globe without drawing direct correlations, we have uprisings and riots and guerrilla warfare, no pun intended, and maybe that's a part of it. And I don't know if that's a direct conversation that the writers of this film were trying to have, but it seems to be an underlying theme. And any response to that, I'll happily take off the air.
Ryan, that's great. We'll go straight to it. Let me use a little clip here from The Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. This was 1972. They came almost annually for a while after the first one. And here you can hear the ape rebellion against enslavement there, led by a chimp in this one as well, named Caesar. He's the son of the scientist couple, Zira and Cornelius, from the previous movies. Here he's giving his revolutionary speech, fire blazing behind him, armed apes as his rapt audience.
We'll lead my people from their captivity, and we shall build our own cities in which there will be no place for humans except to serve our ends. And we shall found our own armies, our own religion, our own dynasty. And that day is upon you now!
From the 1972 Conquest on the Planet of the Apes. Paul Mullins, what about these themes of oppression, the other? Race is something you've paid a lot of attention to looking at these films as they play out over the many manifestations here.
Well, certainly those first five movies increasingly become more and more about racial apocalypse as you go from 68 to 73. And by the last
what do you mean
one,
by racial apocalypse? You use that phrase.
They're all for instance, several of those movies do there are sales of humans that are clearly borrowing from the aesthetics of captive African diaspora slave sales in the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
The sympathetic character is an African American in several of the movies. So there's all these kind of racial themes that are projected onto apes in those first five movies. So it's a little bit different sort of apocalypse, and I think a little different sort of apprehension that's historically a little bit different between 68 and 73 than the apprehensions that we have of ourselves today.
And the racial interpretation in these films, is that still strong in the latest one, Paul, or are we giving way to some other apprehensions and dynamic here?
I think it's very much about different. These movies are historically situated social and political documents, just like all movies are. And they're very different apprehensions. There's a very different context in which the movie and these discussions are being played out, I think, today than there was in 68 and 73. And I think actually this is much more about genetics and apprehension of our ability to shape the world.
Here's a little bit from the 2001 remake that was Tim Burton with Paul Giamatti playing Limbo. This is a profit-seeking orangutan who trades in human slaves. Tim Roth plays the chimpanzee General Thade. In this scene, the general visits Limbo outside the human holding cages.
I promised my niece a pet for her birthday.
Excellent. Oh, the little ones make wonderful pets. But be sure you get rid of it by puberty. One thing you don't want in your house is a human teenager.
Yeah, one thing you don't want in your house. But it gets very... gets very over the top here. This is Beneath the Planet of the Apes, 1970. They just kept coming here. The Cornelius, the scientist chimpanzee, played by Roddy McDowall, reads from their sacred scrolls, which caution against the danger of humans.
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport or lust or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, for he is the harbinger of death.
Ape scripture, not too high on humans. Benjamin, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hello. Something I was observing as I was listening to the previous conversation when they were talking about shoveling off a mantle. I was thinking that maybe part of the draw to this movie is a kind of a tiredness in the American public of, you know, post-Americanism, you know, always being the last superpower left, and now that that's kind of fading away, there's this desire to hand off the world to everybody else.
Interesting. Louis Beale, what do you say? A handoff theme in this latest film?
I still maintain that this is pretty much about scientific anxiety, the fears of a pandemic, the fears of what science is experimenting with, and also the way we treat animals, that animal experimentation. I think it does what the best science fiction has always done. It's taken kind of a futuristic or fantastic look at what our current fears are. And I think really a lot of our fears have to do with scientific experimentation and what we're creating with science these days.
Mm. Sue Savage-Rimbaugh, let me put this web comment to you from Christopher. He says, I think part of the appeal of this film stems from our separation from nature, our primordial human longing for a version of ourselves that is both us and more authentic than us, larger, stronger, more animal, more embedded in the ancient reality of the Earth. Do apes have that claim to be more embedded in the ancient reality, Sue?
Well, they certainly live in the forest, and they make their daily life off what they can gather in the forest, and they make a nest each night in a different place. Humans have built the modern culture you see around us, and even humans that live in the forest use huts, and they bring the food to them, and they store the food, and they categorize the food, and they plant the food. So they, as they do that, they begin to create a world around them that is separate and apart from the natural world, whereas the cultural lifestyle of the ape depends upon understanding the forces and ways and moves and motions of nature and adjusting to them.
In your experience, Sue, does it take the Hollywood treatment for apes to be fascinating to humans?
No, I think that in my personal experience, all a human needs to do is see an ape, and they stop cold in their tracks. They can't take their eyes off of it. They don't really know why they feel the way they do. As long as the ape isn't lying down asleep, it is actually moving. They are so intriguing to humans that we can't stop looking at them. That's one of the reasons they are so powerful in the movie and why apes and entertainment has always been big business.
Do you think we're moving toward, a more sympathetic relationship between species here? It's been a long time since the first one, but do you see a trend, Sue, towards humans granting greater stature to the other, in this case the other species, or not?
Yes, that trend is definitely there, and this movie kind of pushes it over the top. I don't know if it will extend to all other animals. It's a clear fact that apes are self-aware. They're reflective. They understand the other ape in the mirror. They understand theory of mind. They view the world with a cognizance that is of a human quality. A dog, as smart as it is, just doesn't have that kind of cognizance. It's very obvious. But what this movie does is elevate that basic understanding that you get just from watching an ape, it elevates it to a point where the human is willing to and almost eager to look through the eyes and feelings of an ape. Therefore, it begins to humanize apes instead of dehumanize them. Which, how can you dehumanize an ape? It's not really ever a human. But this is humanizing apes in a way that not only is powerful, but it has direct, real relationships to the scientific data that's been collected and actually support what you see in the movie.
Kind of cross-species sympathy there. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, we come to the end of our time. It's been great to have you, primatologist at Great Ape Trust, joining us today from Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you so much, Sue, for being here.
Thank you.
Paul Mullins, will you be on this subject with your students next semester?
Well, certainly.
It's been great to have you with us today from Indianapolis.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being with us. Anthropologist Paul Mullins and Lewis Beale in Raleigh, North Carolina, features writer there. Thank you so much, Lewis, for your thoughts today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we'll go out with a little Gen Cis Freedom from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.